only Democracy Now!, but 24 hours a day. We're asking you to be a BAI buddy. That's $15 or more a month, a sustaining member of WBAI. Help it pay its bills. You can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go to the WBAI website. That's WBAI.org and click buddy. So you can become a buddy. That's a monthly sustainer. $15 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month, or you could make a one-shot contribution to WBAI to help keep it alive. It's independent radio. Independent media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. So go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next is Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for another world. It is possible, and we are the ones who can make it so. Later, Haiti, the struggle continues with Brian Concannon, Executive Director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We'll discuss the deepening crisis in Haiti as a predictable consequence of the years of U.S. support for undemocratic regimes as they dismantled Haiti's democracy. And now the U.S. having just sent troops into Haiti again. First, we're joined by activist, lawyer, investigative journalist Dimitri Lascaris, speaking to us on the ground from the occupied West Bank, most recently in the Jenin refugee camp. And a good tidings to you, Dimitri. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you. And it's I look forward to the conversation, Mimi.
You know, the first thing that I can't help but as I speak with people like you and what you're experiencing and witnessing, I can't help but mention that at least 78 journalists and media workers were killed in Gaza, And that's more than those killed around the world in two decades of conflict, such as in Afghanistan and in the deadliest year of fighting in the Iraq War. So your own thoughts about being there as a journalist and what drives you to put yourself into a situation of such enormous risk?
Well, our access to accurate, comprehensive, and objective information, particularly about war and human rights violations, issues of the utmost consequence to all of humanity, is critical and the foundation of democracy. It's as simple as that, as cliche as it may sound. And we live in an informational ecosystem where the dominant platforms are driven by profit motive, and particularly the enrichment of a narrow elite whose singular purpose is to further enrich itself at our expense. And therefore, we have to resort to other means of acquiring information and communicating it to our fellow citizens. That's what your organization does, WBAI, as Amy Goodman was just saying so eloquently. It's an independent, not-for-profit media organization. And that's the way of the future. I've come here because I am in a position to report on a critically important human rights crisis and a burgeoning war. And I feel it's my duty to do so.
Well, we're going to start with a Sheikh Jarrah, if you will. But maybe the issue of the incredible provocation on the start of Ramadan to deny people access to the most religious worldwide symbols of the religiosity to the people of occupied Palestine. Talk about what you experienced and what you saw happen in neighborhoods on the first day of Ramadan, such as Sheikh Jarrah, the neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem, and access to the mosque, and what that means politically for the ever beleaguered Palestinian people.
Well, I arrived just on the evening when Ramadan began. I arrived on March 10th and came to East Jerusalem, promptly left my suitcase in my room because it was late afternoon, and headed towards Al-Aqsa. And I saw, the first thing that I saw on the way there was a group of young Israeli settlers. They were dancing and chanting and banging a drum in the Muslim quarter about 100 meters from the entrance to Al-Aqsa. They walked by two female Israeli soldiers, as soon as they walked by, the Israeli soldiers, I was right behind them and I was filming them. I've posted this on social media. The Israeli soldiers began to follow them as if to protect them. So I stopped and I spoke to an elderly shopkeeper and I asked him, what were they chanting? Because they were chanting in Hebrew and I couldn't understand it. And he said, look, the details aren't important. They're simply trying to offend us and we do our best not to listen. And then I continued walking along and I eventually, at just about, I would say, 20 meters before the entrance to Al-Aqsa, I looked down an alley to my right, and I saw five young Palestinian men praying at a wall. It was kind of a random wall outside the compound, immediately outside the compound. And I stopped another Palestinian man, and I asked him why they were praying there. And he said, because they were prohibiting large numbers of young Palestinian Muslims from entering the compound that night. This is the first night of Ramadan. And he looked at me and he said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 60. He said, well, they might let you in. So I walked up to the entrance and there were 10 young Palestinian men politely imploring them, the soldiers at the entrance, heavily armed Israeli soldiers, to let them in. They weren't having any success in persuading them. And when there was a pause in the conversation, I looked at the soldier and I said, may I enter? With my accent, I didn't pretend to be anything other than I am. He took a look at me and then he took me by the arm and he pulled me in. He didn't even ask me if I'm Muslim, and I'm not. So I, a non-Muslim, because I'm 60 years old, and perhaps because I have a North American accent, was granted access, whereas young Palestinian Muslims who live in East Jerusalem were being deprived of access. And when I went in, I mean, it was, for me personally, even though I'm not a religious person, it was an extraordinarily moving thing to behold. This mass of people peacefully honoring their God, their religion, their values. But there were vast spaces that were unoccupied. And I was told later on by people who'd been there in more freer time, shall we say, that there oftentimes are hundreds of thousands of people up there. So they clearly were limiting to an extraordinary degree access. I don't know that they were only barring young Palestinian men. They may have been preventing others from entering as well. So the next day I went to Sheikh Jarrah, and I stumbled upon an Arab language institute. I had never been there before, and I was looking for the primary flashpoint where the Al-Kurd family resides. The Palestinian family have put up just extraordinarily heroic, peaceful resistance to the dispossession of their family and others on their street.
Do me a favor, Dimitri, go back to that and explain for people who may not know who the family is or the occurrences in Sheikh Jarrah, the neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem, which go back to really 2021, before the neighborhood, which gained international notoriety after Israel court ordered. Tell us the story about Sheikh Jarrah and its importance, and then catch us up to date what you experienced most recently.
Well, they've been, Israel, first of all, illegally annexed East Jerusalem in, I think it was in 1980 or so. And this has been, the illegality of the annexation has been repeatedly recognized by the UN Security Council. You know, there were resolutions adopted that the United States government did not veto. The UN General Assembly, human rights organizations, including Israeli human rights organizations like the wonderful B'Tselem. This is occupied Palestinian land, East Jerusalem, and Israel's annexation of it and occupation of it are unlawful under international law. It does not, therefore, have the right to apply its domestic laws to domestic legal disputes. It has nonetheless done so. Completely in disregard of international law. And oftentimes it has done so for the purpose of issuing dispossession orders that on some pretext authorize Jewish settlers to physically confiscate the homes of Palestinians who've been living there, in some cases, for their entire lives. And in 2021, the Jerusalem District Court issued such an order with respect to, I think it was five or six homes on a street where the Al-Kurd family resides. They become famous because of the twins, Muna Al-Kurd and her brother, Mohammed Al-Kurd, who now is in the United States studying, I believe. I believe he's become the first Palestinian correspondent of the nation. In any event, they put up a fierce campaign of public awareness. They challenged the order of the district court to the extent that they could. And because of public pressure, the Attorney General of Israel, when the matter was appealed to the Israel Supreme Court, asked for the court to delay its decision. So right now, as I understand it, they're in a state of limbo. But by the way, I should also add that even under the domestic laws of Israel, the decision of the Jerusalem District Court is highly suspect because there was voluminous archival evidence put to them that the families actually had valid legal title to the land under Israeli law. I went there. That's the background, not having actually visited it, but I was well aware of the history. And I looked for that street where the Al-Kurd family is, and some people in an Arab language institute kindly led me there. And they just, I had never spoken to the Al-Kurd family before, and they told me, just go knock on the door. So I went and I knocked on the door, and Muna Al-Kurd appeared at the door. She was hesitant at first. I explained who I was, and then she kindly led me into her front yard and showed me the houses that are under threat and showed me the one house which has been successfully confiscated. It's directly across the street from hers, and there is a large Israeli flag draped across the front gate. So I really wasn't at that point early in my excursion minded to try to speak to the settlers that were across the street. I frankly am a bit surprised I was allowed into the country because I'm an outspoken critic of Israel, a peaceful one, but nonetheless an outspoken critic. So I didn't want to draw too much attention myself early on. And I issued a report about what Muna Al-Kurd told me and talked about the history of the this flashpoint.
And fast forward to this current period. What did Muna tell you? What's the climate? What's the atmosphere? Is there even more suppression and more aggression? And I should say this cast against the fact that yesterday I went to a demonstration against the Israeli land sales here in this country of expropriated, confiscated, stolen Palestinian land, which is actually being sold here from realtors. And the same thing was taking place with a demonstration against this practice in New Jersey. So this is now throughout this country that realtors are engaging in the practice of selling off Palestinian, stolen Palestinian land. So what did Muna tell you? What's the issue right now that is unfolding in that part of the occupied Palestine?
Well, just before I answer your question, I want to point out that what you just described is happening in Canada as well, where I come from. And somebody, a journalist, an independent journalist from an outlet called Pivot in Montreal, attended one of these things undercover and recorded one of these real estate agents telling, saying to her, posing as a potential customer, that if she bought this land, his words were, the Palestinians will never get it back. And it was explicitly being offered to her as land in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. But to answer your question, you know, her English was rather broken. She tends to communicate in Arabic, so she wasn't able to give me too much detail. But I certainly got the sense from her, and I'll tell you that this is a message that I've received from every single Palestinian I've spoken to in my time here, and I've spoken to dozens of them. They have never seen this level of brutality. They've never seen this level of aggression. They literally don't know from one minute to the next, not only whether they're going to retain their home, but whether they're going to be alive the next day. And the viciousness with which they're being attacked is something that they find beyond imagining. They're shocked, even having endured what they've endured their entire lives. That's a consistent theme that I've heard. And I think in the current climate, it would not surprise me if people, for example, like the El-Kurd family, absent a court order, were simply physically expelled from their homes on pain of death. That's the kind of environment that exists currently in Israel. There's a level of extremism. I mean, I've been here, this is my fifth time being here. I came in 2016, and I thought I had seen it all, Mimi. I'm astonished at what I've witnessed, particularly in the refugee camps.
Dmitry, I want you to take us into the Jenin refugee camp. And as part of your sojourn through occupied Palestine and certainly the occupied West Bank, talk about what happened in the refugee camp of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. And I know that you experienced and broke the story of another kind of massacre that occurred there. And then we'll hear about your experience with friends of ours in this station, which is the Jenin Freedom Theater. But tell us about what was experienced in the hospital to again get the idea and the notion across that the media does not depict here of the level of brutality and massacre. And I think the ethnocide that is occurring throughout Palestine to Judaicize all of the historic landmass of Palestine.
Well, I went to Jenin actually 2 days, yesterday and the day before. And I wasn't intending to go back a second day. I was intending to spend all of yesterday at the Tulkarm refugee camp. But when we woke up in the morning, we heard there had been an atrocity at a hospital. I just want to point out that on the prior day, the first day that I went to Jenin, we walked in there and we saw, again, astonishing levels of destruction. Homes demolished, numerous homes demolished, numerous homes damaged beyond habitability, homes burnt out, set on fire. We saw roads torn apart by D9 bulldozers. And the first people we spoke to that morning, their house had been attacked by a unit of the Israeli military. They showed up at the door. They were searching for the eldest son. I think they had three or four sons. He was not there at the time. And they entered the house. They blew out the door. They entered the house. They ransacked the bedroom. They found the younger sons. They took the mother and held her as a human shield at the front door of the home while they savagely beat the sons. And this went on for 90 minutes. And then they took away one of the sons to an unknown location to be interrogated by the Shin Bet. And their other son is, you know, in hiding, the one that they were actually, the Israeli military was actually searching for. So that's just to give you a flavor of what I saw on day one. On day two, when we woke up, we heard overnight there was gunfire. We weren't staying in the camp, but we were staying a few kilometers away. And we received reports in the morning that there had been killings at the hospital, the Jenin Governmental Hospital, which is right on the edge of the camp and right across the street from a Palestinian Authority police headquarters, which looks actually like a military base. Literally 20 meters from the entrance to the emergency ward of this hospital, you'll find this, you know, headquarters of the PA police. And when we arrived there, we asked to speak to the hospital director. He was being interviewed by an Arabic language media outlet. I didn't see any Western media there while I was there. And he kindly gave us 15 minutes of his time. And he explained to us that there had been a number of inquiries made with witnesses, eyewitnesses to what had happened. And they had reviewed security tapes, videotapes from two security cameras, one immediately outside the entrance to the emergency ward, one immediately on the inside to the entrance of the emergency ward. And based on what they were able to piece together, a unit of Israeli military showed up outside the compound of the hospital. Young Palestinian men and some middle-aged Palestinian men came into the compound of the hospital to seek refuge. And they were all unarmed. There's absolutely no evidence that any of them was armed. And that's at a certain point, as they were standing outside the emergency ward, snipers, Israeli snipers, we believe, based on all that we know, directed gunfire at them. And they turned, and in order to seek cover, they ran into the emergency ward. And two of them were killed as they were running into the emergency ward, and four were injured. And when we were there, four were being treated. One of them died instantly. And we asked the director of the hospital whether he would show us the videos, and he said that he couldn't hand over. We actually wanted him to produce copies of the videotapes to us. He said he couldn't do that without the permission of the Ministry of Health of the Palestinian Authority. And it's my understanding from my contacts that we're not likely to receive them because of that requirement. But in any event, he kindly pulled out his cell phone because he had the videos on his cell phone, and he showed them to us. And I watched them twice, along with a colleague of mine. And there's no doubt in my mind that one of the two men who was killed was shot in the back at the very moment when he crossed from the compound into the entrance of the emergency ward. He immediately collapsed in a pool of blood. Some seconds later, I think it was an orderly, sort of half picked up his body and dragged it away from the door. They were going to try to save his life. And you could see clearly that there was no weapon under him, no firearm whatsoever, no weapon of any nature, not just a firearm. But there was a massive pool of blood, and he wasn't moving. And they tried to resuscitate him, but they were not successful. And the next morning, we headed over to a cemetery, which was actually intended to be an expansion of the Freedom Theater that you just mentioned earlier, but they've turned it into a cemetery because so many people in the camp have been killed since October 7th. And they were to bury these two young men there after the noon prayer or the midday prayer, but they actually expedited the burial and did it with minimal attendance and in secrecy because they had heard that there were operatives, assassins effectively, of the Israeli military in the camp in civilian clothing, waiting for people to assemble for the funeral. So by the time we got to the cemetery, they had been buried. We saw the fresh graves. We took footage of them, but we didn't actually see the burial.
And we are speaking with Dimitri Lascaris, an activist journalist lawyer, about his sojourn through the Middle East, specifically on the ground from occupied Palestine. And we now are in the West Bank and speaking about a particular massacre that occurred in the Jenin refugee camp. And take us into our audience should be familiar with, because we've done programming with the marvelous Jenin refugee camp, and we already know that people who listen to this program, that this theater group has been terrorized, its principals beaten, arrested, humiliated, and that the theater itself has a major part in preserving and extending the cultural existence of the Palestinian people, which is similarly an objective of Israel, and that is to wipe out all the culture. It's to wipe out the people, theft the land, and to eradicate all cultural indicia of the nation of Palestine. But that's my politicizing. But tell us what you experienced as you met with Tubasi, who is one of the heads of the marvelous, marvelous Jenin Freedom Theater that tries to keep on keeping on despite the aggressions against its very existence.
Well, this theater that you mentioned, it's a wonderful place. It's a small theater adorned with inspiring artwork at the entrance all around. And it was founded during the First Intifada. I believe it was in the late 80s or perhaps early 90s by an extraordinary individual by the name of Arna Mer Kamis, who was an Israeli Jew who was committed passionately and courageously to the defense of Palestinian human rights. And as I understand it, chose to live among them for much of her life. So she and Palestinian women from the camp founded the theater back then. I believe it was called the Stone Theater initially. It was destroyed, as I understand it, during the Second Intifada. And then I believe by that point in time, Mer Kamis had passed away. But it was resurrected as the Freedom Theater after the Second Intifada, after it was destroyed. So we had the opportunity to inspect what had been done to it. We walked in, it had been ransacked, and in the main theater area, soldiers who had ransacked it had painted the Star of David on the walls. We then had the opportunity to speak to Ahmed Tobasi, an extraordinarily eloquent gentleman who speaks wonderful English and passionate, poetic in his discussion of the history of the Freedom Theater and their commitment to artistic integrity. And he sat down for a good half an hour and described that on within days of the October 7th attacks, a large incursion of Israeli military occurred at the camp, and they came to the Freedom Theater where they ransacked it, and they arrested him and his colleagues, beat them savagely, took them to some kind of temporary detention point outside the camp, held them in humiliating conditions. They were barely dressed. They were beaten. They were blindfolded. They were in the cold. They were in the rain. And eventually, after 24 hours, he was released. But his colleague, who I believe is the producer, is still in detention somewhere, and they don't know where. I don't even know that he's sure that his colleague is alive, frankly. And he told me, he's one of these people who told me that he has never seen this level of brutality. It was as though they came with the intention to inflict as much suffering as they could and to revel in the suffering of the camp's residents, irrespective of whether they had any complicity or not in any acts of violence that had been committed against Israeli civilians. And he said to me, you know, it's unimaginable. You can only dream what this is like. It's a nightmare. But literally, we do not know from one day to the next, one minute to the next, whether we will live, whether a drone will kill us, whether a sniper's bullet will take us, whether a bomb will fall upon our homes, our places of work, our places of leisure. You know, I don't know how we stay sane in this this environment. And I just want to say one other thing. He stressed this repeatedly. He places the blame squarely upon the United States government and its Western allies for the suffering not only of the Palestinian people, but for the entire region, and in fact, oppressed peoples everywhere. And I suggest that if people want to hear this eloquent man explain why he takes that position, they should listen to his interview, because he said it better than I ever could, frankly. I fully share that opinion, and that's precisely why I spend so much time criticizing my own government, the Canadian government.
Well, since you mentioned the U.S. and you mentioned the Canadian government and so on, I know that you had an opportunity in Amman, I believe it was, or perhaps Qatar, to deal with an arms manufacturing market. Take us to that. And again, let's really understand the complicity. There's blood on the U.S. hands. There's blood on the Canadian hands. But most specifically, let's understand what that means in terms of stop dropping your darn tins of food and allow the people to live by stopping dropping the bombs. So let's figure out what you uncovered or experienced when you went to these Western arms manufacturers' markets and their killing machines in Qatar.
Precisely what they are. And I had planned for some time, basically from the beginning of the year, I had planned to set aside the month of March to travel, not throughout the Middle East, but to various countries where there's some form of organized resistance to Western hegemony. That was my goal. And I intended to start the trip in Amman, but I was visiting my sister in Cyprus and I couldn't find a reasonable ticket. The only ticket I could find had me go, required me to fly to Frankfurt and then from there to Amman. So I instead took a flight to Doha on Qatar Airways, intending only to stay there for a couple of days and then head to Amman. I'd never been to Doha before. And upon my arrival there, I learned entirely by accident that a major, weapons bazaar, I prefer to call it, was taking place at the Qatari National Convention Center, this massive facility, over the very time that I was in Doha. So I immediately went online. It's called DIMDEX. It's called the Doha International Maritime Defense Exhibition. And I put in an online application, again, frankly, expecting that it would be rejected. I'd never worked for a military contractor. I'm not a government official, and I have a long record of vigorously condemning the military-industrial complex. But to my great surprise, they not only accepted my registration, but I wasn't required to pay anything for it. So I went to the exhibition hall, the convention center, the next day. It was an absolutely gigantic facility. What they'd done was this facility consists of five exhibition halls next to each other. They had opened up the entire thing to accommodate the weaponry that they were putting on display. And I pulled out my camera after noticing that there were others who were filming. So I confirmed that, you know, video photography was permitted. I didn't ask permission. I just saw others doing it. I pulled it out and I began walking around from one end to the other, commenting on what I was seeing. What I saw was that 80 to 90% of the arms manufacturers there were weapons manufacturers. Right in the middle of this massive exhibition, I mean, this was several football fields, that's how big it was, were the American arms manufacturers. General Dynamics was there, Boeing was there, the names now escape me, but it's all the usual suspects. Then beside them were the British military contractors. Further on, there were the German and the French military contractors. And then on the other side of the American military contractors, there was actually a quite large space being occupied by Turkish military contractors. I didn't realize how many arms manufacturers there are in Turkey. There are quite a few. And tucked away in one corner, a distant corner, as far away as possible from the Western arms manufacturers as possible, as they could put it, was an Iranian pavilion. And so a couple of things I noticed was that even though this was intended for maritime defense, there were a lot of armored vehicles, massive tanks, and land-based air defense systems and surface-to-surface missiles on display. The thing that really caught my attention, though, was the number of drones. everybody was, just about everybody there was selling drones of every imaginable type. And one of them was selling drones, which were explicitly being marketed as being operated by artificial intelligence, which is a horrifying thought, in my opinion. But this is obviously a real profit center based on what I saw for arms manufacturers nowadays. And if you actually have been following the Ukraine war as I have been following it, I think what we're learning from that war is that drones have increased the lethality of modern warfare to an extraordinary degree, because what they do is they allow munitions to be used with far greater precision than they otherwise would be used. And so drones kill very, very efficiently, and they're also relatively inexpensive to make. So these things are an extraordinary threat to us all, frankly. And if I were, you know, involved in the peace movement, and I am, I mean, those of you out there who are, you know, share that passion for the peace movement that I do, you should put it at the top of your to-do list to educate your fellow citizens about the threats that drone warfare poses to us all.
Well, Dmitry, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there and move to another crisis area, as our next guest is in the wings, waiting, Brian Concannon, to talk about what's happening in Haiti, which is not at all unreminiscent of what's happening in Gaza. But perhaps you can take us to your conclusion from this extraordinary, terrifying travelogue. And I just want to leave with my own thoughts. You know, here we are talking about dropping 37,000 meals. Gaza needs a minimum of 800 trucks of food and medical supplies per day. Over 2,000 trucks are at the borders waiting for weeks. Open up the Rafah crossing. Stop the bombing. That is ceasefire now, permanent ceasefire, and surely for self-determination. But in the minute or so that we have left, your conclusion about what you've uncovered and how it informs your political position.
Well, after I went to Dimdex, I drove out to the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East, Al Ubaid, which is about 30 kilometers from Doha. And what I noticed was that this was one barren land, Qatar. And I mean, there's literally nothing out there but white rock. And it was immediately obvious to me, as it should be to us all, that the only reason why we have invested so many military assets in this region is oil. We, the West, have destroyed this region. We have deprived people of their right to self-determination. We have undermined democracy. We have effectively tortured the peoples of the Middle East for one reason and one reason only, and that's oil. And it's time for us to get out and to give them their freedom.
Dmitry Lascaris, thank you for that terrifying but imperatively necessary travelogue for people to hear, for boots on the ground. Keep the pressure on. Indeed, we have to extend and accelerate it. And the messaging to the U.S., not only ceasefire now, but stop the funding of the genocide that is occurring in Gaza and a rolling Holocaust throughout the occupied land of Palestine. Dmitry Lascaris, stay safe. Thank you for your work in informing us, for educating, agitating, and helping to organize us for a free, free Palestine.
And thank you for yours, Mimi. It's been a pleasure.
Please stay safe.
Thank you.
Les peuples qui lundi prennent fusil, yo connaît yo bouquet. La médecine internationale, ça met colle sous côté. Yo fait réunion, yo parle, yo rancé. Devant vers champagne, bon divin, qu'importe, c'est la s'arrêter. Les peuples en bas, âme, tout pays, tout côté. Moi, je m'étends des autres cap analyser, l'aile pas concerné. L'aile pas concerné. Tout ça, mon bab, l'étendé, c'est vérité liée. Réactionnaire sous développé.
Well, thank you, Michael G. Haskins, master of incidental music, as you were designated by our wonderful Hugh Hamilton for that Mano Shalameim piece. And now we are joined by Brian Concannon, the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which he co-founded back in 2004. And Brian, Haiti's deepening crisis, you say, is a predictable consequence of years of U.S. support for undemocratic regimes as they dismantle Haiti's democracy. And I want that to be our starting point. And on the very day after U.S. troops have again been sent into Haiti. Thank you for joining us. Get us started on that conversation and help us understand what the true nature of the crisis in Haiti is.
Well, thank you, Mimi. It's good to be with you, but it's obviously distressing that we're having to discuss this, because it wasn't just predictable, as you said, it was also predicted. I mean, I've been discussing this on your show for years, and members of the U.S. Congress, Haitian American leaders, and most importantly, the Haitian people have been saying this was going to happen for the last 3 years. The Biden administration has ignored it, hoping that Haiti would stay under the radar screen, and despite the suffering on Haitian people, and here we are. Haiti's now in a situation where most Haitians are not able to even leave their house, especially in Port-au-Prince, the main area, and the civil society is being forced into an extremely difficult dilemma where they have a choice between participating in a political agreement that seriously undermines Haitian sovereignty and sets the stage for continued lack of democracy, or sitting out and allowing groups allied with gangs take over Haiti's election process.
First, I want to just get to the gangs, quote unquote, for a moment, because I'm always suspect of that categorization. Are these not, and there are some folks that have said, well, they're not really gangs. They are nascent, perhaps from the lumpen, but nascent organizational vehicles to counter the oligarchy that has controlled, with the assent and complicity of Western powers, Haiti for years, that it is not the problem of the gangs. And indeed, recently, Jimmy Chevalier, also known as Porkchop, has one of the quote-unquote gang leaders, has been spoken about by the Western media, and one is led to believe that these are indeed a unit that could bring integrity to the Haitian people and representation from the grassroots. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think you're right that gangs is probably not a great word. Armed groups may be more accurate, although it's a very complicated and fluid situation that defies easy explanations. But the gangs have, many of the gangs have constituencies within their turf. They do what armed groups do all over the world. They provide some services within their area, including security. They also do some development work and sometimes even, help maintain the roads and things like that. And they provide jobs, of course. That does provide some goodwill within the population. But I have not seen any of the main armed groups do the types of things that you need to do to move to a broader political platform. I don't see them making alliances with broad-based, consistently progressive organizations. I don't see them, going out and working with farmers. I don't see them providing, healthcare outside of their areas. So a lot of the types of things that typically you see armed groups do that are part of a broader political platform are not not happening in Haiti. And, you know, there's 12 million Haitians, and there's obviously diversity of view on a range of issues within Haiti. But none of the people that I'm in touch with believe that the armed groups have potential to lead a, you know, a progressive or a pro-democracy movement.
And I misspoke before when I mentioned, I said pork chop. Jimmy Chauvisier is actually known as barbecue. But I'm interested in your thoughts about why suddenly the American media is lifting him up and giving him the kind of play. I mean, what do you think is the politic behind that? And how are we to understand the dilemma of Ariel Henry, who is not able to re-enter the country, and his role in the, shall we say, spiraling down of economically and politically of the Haitian, the valiant, resilient Haitian people's efforts towards democracy?
I think the attention to Chauvisier, a part of it is clickbait. You know, it's a very easy way for journalists to come up with a story that people are going to click on, because consumers can understand that, and people are attracted to those kinds of stories. And it's actually not new, in the sense that back around the 2004 coup, one of the leaders of that coup was a man named Guy Philippe, who's very photogenic and he's very media savvy. And he was portrayed as this kind of savior of Haiti. He was on all the news shows and, you know, generally held out as this is the new messiah for Haiti. When Haitians had an opportunity to vote for Guy Philippe in the 2006 elections, he got a little bit less than 2% of the vote. And I think you're probably going to see a similar dynamic in Haiti today. Guy Philippe, again, is also, along with Chauvisier, he's being kind of held out as this is the future of Haiti. I think it's just something that it's easy for journalists to get their head around. It avoids dealing with the more complex issues of U.S. support for Haiti's, repressive regimes and its failure to stop the flow of guns to the gangs, and also avoids dealing with a very complicated but essential issue of how Haitian civil society is going to try to grab its democracy back.
So let's take us to quote-unquote prime minister, unelected as such, Ariel Henry, who was stranded in San Juan on his way back from Kenya, where he was to sign an agreement for Kenyan police to come to bolster his repressive, corrupt, and unpopular regime, i.e. a mercenary force, as I see it, and now the U.S. actually sending troops in. But we are told, and the picture painted in U.S. media is, but what is to be done? This is, in fact, a humanitarian effort that is safeguarding the general public from the terror of the gangs and so on. So your understanding, your analysis of the troops that have been sent in Kenya, and indeed the role that the uplifting and supporting all this time of Ariel Henry has meant for Haiti. Who's to blame?
That's a great point. And it's important to note that Ariel Henry was not appointed by any Haitian process. He was appointed by the core group, which is led by the United States. I mean, literally, they put out a press release saying Henry gets to be prime minister, and that worked. And Haitians agree with you that the Kenyan mission is really, it's mercenaries. I mean, it's not technically mercenaries are people working for private organizations, and these are state police, but they're there for the money. And so they're functioning as mercenaries. The In terms of the mission, it has not yet been deployed, which is important. And one of the reasons, so for example, on Tuesday, the Kenyan foreign ministry said, well, we're going to suspend deployment because we need a government to work with, and we're not going to just send our police down with no government to work with. That was on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken called up Kenya's president, William Ruto, and Ruto then went to the Security Council and said, no, we really are going to send them as soon as this transitional presidential council can be put in place. And the presidential council is really something that the U.S. has corralled Haitian civil society into. It created this 7-member entity, and it left organizations that have a chance of winning fair elections with the choice of either participating in a flawed process or sitting out and letting people connected with the repressive regime and the armed groups set the rules for the next elections. And as part of participating in this, one of the things they had to accept was the deployment of the multinational force. And, you know, this is deeply subversive of democracy. The fact, I mean, if you just sort of think about it, the United States, that a candidate could only be a candidate for president if you agreed to an occupation force that was designed to prop up your predecessor. I mean, it's just, you know, absolutely nuts if you look at it in terms of advancing in democracy in Haiti. It's a very effective ploy if your goal is to prevent progressive democracy from breaking out in Haiti, which is really what the United States is doing.
And let's just plow deeper into the role of the U.S., the role of France, the role of Canada, and I'm sad to say even Brazil and so on, that have really struck at the heart of this valiant people, the Haitian people, the first Black Republic, and the first to eliminate slavery in the Western Hemisphere, this incredible people that defeated Napoleon's army initially, the Spanish. How are we to understand the role of the U.S., the Western powers, primarily at this point in the, again, spiraling down and the prevention of the Haitian people realizing self-determination, democracy, and God knows they should have gotten their reparations a long time ago for the money that was thieved from them by the Western powers. But take us to that very complex issue which you've been thinking about, studying, and working around for years, Brian Concannon.
Yeah, that's a great question. And often when I'm talking on mainstream media, people act like I'm crazy when I'm saying it's a bad idea to impose a hated occupation force that was designed to prop up a repressive government on the Haitian people. But of course, the Haitian people completely agree with that analysis. But so does actually most of the international community. Back a year and a half ago, when the U.S. started to process this, they asked Canada to lead it. And Canada said, no, we're not going to do this. It's a bad idea because it's propping up a hated government. They asked CARICOM. CARICOM said the same thing. But this was like an abusive relationship. The U.S. just kept coming back after Canada and CARICOM and telling them no, they had to do it. And then they went to Brazil. Brazil rejected participating in the mission for the same thing. Then they asked several West African countries. They disagreed. Kenya, they finally said, gave Kenya enough money to do it. But when Kenyans sent a mission to examine conditions in Haiti, they said, no, we're not going to do it. We're going to do a much more limited mission. But then the U.S. said, no, that's not an acceptable answer, and pushed Kenya back into this. So this is a crazy situation where almost every country in the world besides the United States that has opined on the issue has said at one time or another that this is a really bad idea to deploy this occupation force. But because the U.S. is the 8,000-pound gorilla in the hemisphere, it's getting what it wants despite everybody else agreeing that this is deeply damaging to Haitian society.
You seem to indicate that now, one way or the other, that the Haitian people are stuck with this presidential council that has been set up. Talk about where, in the unfortunately brief time that we have left, although we will continue to follow the situation as we have for decades in Haiti, what is it that can happen and must happen for the self-determination of the Haitian people? What should be our position as good allies of a Haitian-American coalition for self-determination for Haiti?
I think there's a lot that can be done as allies to this because, you know, Haitians, as you've mentioned several times, Haitians are valiant. They're not going to stop resisting. They're going to keep fighting. They're eventually going to win, but they're going to pay a huge price, and they're paying a huge price. Our role is to reduce the price that Haitians pay to get their democracy back. And we can reduce that because it's decisions being made with our tax dollars in our name that is right now the principal impediment to democracy in Haiti. I think we need to take the lead of Haitian organizations. And we have, you know, on our website, www.ijdh.org or haitijustice.org, we have lots of statements from Haitian organizations. I think we also need to follow the lead of the National Haitian American Elected Officials Network, which is pushing the administration. And we have, I've been in calls all day yesterday and this morning with different Haitian American groups. And I think there's a very strong sense of coming together to do some collective action. So we'll get that information up on our website and out on our social media as soon as we can. But I'm expecting within, you know, days, perhaps a week or two, we're going to have some very strong, united Haitian American platforms with some clear asks for the administration.
And we've touched on it, but I just want to go back to that. The issue of just last night, the sending of U.S. troops to presumably guard, or to guard, the presidential palace and so on, couched as a humanitarian effort to stem the tide of violence of the gangs, the issue of God knows if they even will attempt to bring Ariel Henry back to Haiti, and certainly the issue of the Kenyan troops, which have not yet been sent there, but which are strongly advocated for by the U.S. How are we to view and understand this?
Well, I think one way of viewing it is through your last segment on Gaza. At the same time that the U.S. has been propping up this government that is pushing Haitians to flee for their lives, we've been capturing Haitians on the ocean and sending them back. Even Tuesday, as bad as things got, it didn't get bad enough that the U.S. could not send 62 Haitians that it picked up off the coast of the Bahamas back. Just yesterday, the administration said that it was thinking of opening up Guantanamo Bay for Haitians. Oh, and, you know, it's important to remember way before we started using it for people in the quote war on terror, Guantanamo was used to hold Haitians in a concentration camp when the President George W. Bush administration had supported a coup d'etat that caused Haitians to flee. So we are, you know, making giving some lip service to humanitarian concerns while we keep Haitians trapped in a place that they're subject to gang violence that we helped generate.
And most significantly, what's the messaging to the U.S. government, which, of course, is to let Haitians come together and make their way out of the current crisis? But if you could, just in the minute or so that we have left, our duty, our responsibility, what is it that we need to tell the United States in terms of letting Haitians live?
You know, it really is that simple, letting Haitians live. None of this is complicated. Haitians have a long history of coming together and negotiating and building consensus as a way of getting out of crises when we let them. We just need – we don't have to do something expensive. We don't have to do something complicated. We just have to do less. We have to sit down and let Haitians move their way, vote and negotiate and talk their way out of this current crisis.
Well, the United States certainly needs to let that process happen without interference. However, give them the money back that you keep taking. Give them the money back that has been taken since independence from the remarkable Haitian people who really set the pace for the issue of democracy in the Western Hemisphere and around the world. Brian Kincannon, just 5 seconds. Give us the website again to continue to get more information.
Sure. It's www.haitijustice.org.
And Brian is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, a great source of information. We did also try to get a guest on the ground in Haiti. That was not able to happen. Their internet process was consistently cut off, but I can assure you we will have our siblings from Haiti on the ground fully amplifying their perspective. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. You've been listening to Equal Rights and Justice, and it is our duty to make that so there can